welcome back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, L. Ariel, and we can be found at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. We're also on all the streaming platforms, Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher Podcast, Android, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and more. If you are on one of those streaming platforms, we always love if you can give us some stars, show us some love, give us some feedback, tell us what you think, because we would love to get bumped up in the rankings, have more people find out about us, because we are all about how to get a career in music. We talk to the movers and shakers and innovators from all aspects of the music industry to find out exactly how they got their job. What decisions did they make? What paths did they choose? What obstacles did they face? What advice or experience did they have to share if you want to get into that particular job in the music industry? So we got it all here, and we always love to get your feedback and find out what you think of the podcast. So my last guest was the wonderful Brad Siegel. He has an incredible music library at Fine Tune Music, and he is a music industry veteran. He's a film composer, TV composer. His music's been featured in so many films and TV shows, and he talks all about his career, starting out as writing jingles for ad agencies. He was a classically trained pianist from Juilliard. Just really, really interesting. I urge you to go on back and listen to it. It's a really good interview. So my next guest, I'm very happy to welcome Sarah Klayman and Kevin Nixon of Dime. Dime is an incredible music institute. They are all about preparing music students for long-lasting careers in the music industry. It's all about modern music, how to make it in modern music. So just really incredible work that they're doing. They're both very, very talented music industry veterans themselves. They're going to tell you all about that. But first, we're going to get started with a track. This is a track that Kevin co-wrote with an artist from the Dime Detroit School. Her name is Charity. It's called Morning. I have to admit, this song brought tears to my eyes. It's very beautiful. So take a listen.
Come on, come on, morning. Save me from the night. I heard you make things better, so keep me in your light. I'm running from my shadow and running from the pain. Come on, come on, morning, chase these clouds away. They say joy comes in the morning, it's hard to believe. When I wake up every morning, and I
Hey, Sarah and Kevin,
breathe. Welcome
to Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? Very happy to have you both here on the show.
Great, thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you. We're very glad to be here.
Yeah. So, Kevin, let's start with you. Tell me about your first music memory. What's your first memory of listening to music, noticing music when you were growing up?
My God. My first music memory was going to see my granddad. He was a band leader in a hotel in York, where I'm from. The hotel was called the Chase Hotel. I don't know how old I was, but I was very, very young. Probably as young as two, I would think. And he used to rehearse in the afternoons up in the hotel. And I just have this very vague memory of watching him, because I then subsequently saw him play many times there. But that very first time, I was with my mum. And it was just this, like, incredible experience where I was transfixed by what happened, and so consequently, she would take me every time it was possible to go.
Sarah, what about you? What's your first music memory?
I have so many. My father is actually a promoter in the UK and Europe, and so I grew up in the music industry. He's promoted artists such as Tom Jones, Shirley Bassey. He did Riverdance, Michael Jackson, Barbara Streisand, so had an incredible career. So from a very, very early age, I was the young girl who was very interested in hanging out with my dad whenever I could during summer holidays and working in his office. I think one of the earliest memories I had was being at a Jack Jones concert, and I was tiny, so I was sitting up high on the seat, and Jack Jones came into the audience and sang a song to me. And I remember shrinking down.
Oh, wow.
And just going bright red. And then at the end of the show, all these women are coming up to me going, "You're so lucky, he sang a song to you." And I was like, so embarrassed, probably about 4 years old.
I love that. Well, let's continue with that. So, Sarah, where did you feel like this was it? Like, did you start taking lessons? Did you start, studying music? What would that look like?
I was never a natural musician. I can't sing in tune at all. It's just not my thing. I loved music growing up. I used to play the piano, play the flute, but I never imagined myself being a musician and being in front and on the stage. But I always thought that I wanted to work in the arts behind the stage, and I had a lot of experience through my dad and contacts that he gave me just working on big concerts. I worked at the Dominion Theatre in London, and I really loved behind the scenes, and I knew quite early on that it was something I wanted to do and wanted to be.
Interesting. Okay, so Kevin, what about you? Did you feel, at a young age that you were destined for music? Were you taking lessons? What did that look like?
It never actually occurred to me to do anything else because I'm from a very big jazz family. So my granddad, my mom, my granddad, besides being a band leader, was also a jazz guitar player, a brilliant one. My mum's got four brothers who are also jazz guitarists and bass players. And my mum had me when she was a teenager, so I was the next one along with my uncles. My granddad taught us all to play when we were little kids. And we had a family ukulele that you got when you were 5 years old. And you had to stick with that for two years. And when you were seven, your hands were big enough to get a guitar. So we all got the same ukulele. Actually, we all got the same guitar as well when we were seven. So, yeah, I was always going to be a musician. There was never really any option.
And did you take lessons or you were just learning from the family?
No, we all were ear trained. My granddad played with people like Stefan Grappelli and people like that during the war. So we all grew up listening to Django Reinhardt and that gypsy jazz thing, and we all still play it now, actually. Mm. None of that music was ever written down. Never occurred to us, really, that we needed to learn to read music. And sure enough, we've all had careers throughout our lives as musicians, and somehow we've managed to do it without being readers. Mm. It's just been the most incredible thing,
So, Sarah, did you decide to go off to a music school or business school, or what were kind of your next steps?
Well, my next steps, really, I was not very inspired by education. Obviously, I grew up in the UK, lived in North London, wasn't inspired with education, was a very creative young person, really inquisitive, always putting my hand up in class, and unfortunately my teachers used to tell me to be quiet and try to kind of disencourage me from having the personality that I had. My sister also went to the same school. She's only 18 months, she's 13 months older than me, and she was an academic. She was a very good student, she was very studious, and we were like chalk and cheese growing up. I was the ringleader. I wanted to have fun. I had this big personality, inquisitive, putting my hand up the whole time. So I didn't love school. My father grew up in the East End of London, and he left school at 13 years old, and he found his way into the music industry, and he is my biggest inspiration. And so once I'd finished, in England you can leave school at 16, so I took GCSEs, and once I finished, I just wanted to go out into the working world. My parents were concerned that I didn't want to go on into higher education, so Dad said to me, look, can you do me a favour, can you spend 1 year doing a secretarial course, which means you will always be employable because you'll always have a skill, and then you can go off and do what you want. So I left school at 16. I did this secretarial course for a year, and then I went traveling. I lived in Israel. I worked for a medical company. I was a nanny. I lived on kibbutz. I had an incredible time. And then after I was out there for about 2.5 years, I came back to England, and I found that I could be employable because I had these secretarial skills behind me. So I worked over the summer, and I was earning probably four times more money per hour than any of my friends because I had this skill, and I was considered a skilled employee at that time. So it was through that that I started to work in theatres. I started to do touring. I did tour management. And I just knew I wanted to be in the music industry. And, you know, my dad helped me get some of these jobs. But also it was harder for me because there were people that I was working for that would say, well, she's only here because she's Barry Clayman's daughter. And what does she know? You know? And so I felt that I had to triple prove myself and say, no, I do deserve to be here. I'm not here just because my family name's Clayman. Mm. Because of that and because of my father's work ethic, I had incredible drive and I found myself in the music industry. And, you know, every job I did better than the last job, you know, and I just love the music industry. I think it's an incredible place for any young person to be in. And I think that regardless of skills and talent, there's something in the music industry for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And I think, too, the fact that it wasn't just you going on this linear direct path to the music, that you know, you took the secretarial course, you traveled extensively, you worked at, you know, in a medical field, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you had this almost like circuitous route, but it's still ultimately, as you're saying, the same skills could apply to the work that you ultimately were doing in the music industry.
It was about work ethic. It was about being confident. It was about being communicative. If I didn't know how to do something, I had the confidence to ask. And once someone showed me how to do something once, I made sure I remembered it. You know, so I had the fortunate experience of working on a Michael Jackson tour for 3 months. I was on a Prince tour for 5 months. I toured with Power Rangers. I've done incredible things, you know, and I felt really lucky. But I was always really well liked and respected. And that, I think, was the thing that kind of drove me and made me get out of bed in the morning. And I worked really hard. I burnt the candle at both ends. But I knew that if I was going to go to a Prince after show in Frankfurt at 1 o'clock in the morning, I still had to be up at 6 a.m. at his real show because I was doing production assistant work. You know, I had to be there. So,
wow.
You know, it trained me well, you know.
Yeah, that's great. All right, Kevin, so how did you sort of approach, did you have to go continue school or did you also leave school? Tell us about that.
Okay, so I was a working musician from being 14. And the reason was that those uncles that I was telling you about, they were all working. And where I grew up in the north of England, there are things called working men's clubs. And they are venues. And there's loads of them in the north of England, hundreds. And they pay really well. You have to play for a long time, like 4 hours a night. And so my uncles, being quite young, you know, they were playing in these clubs for money. That was the only real reason to do it. And because they were also developing their music careers in bands, just like anybody else, really. There was so much work. Like, everybody in our house went to work at 6 p.m. because they were all playing shows. Mm. And eventually, you know, I was good enough where they would ask me if I would like to dep, which is, you know, deputize. The first couple of shows, I did it, and I did a good job. So I continued to get loads of work. By the time I was 16, I was playing 7 nights a week. And
wow.
I actually...
Can I just interrupt one second? Sorry. Can you... Because I don't think our listeners will know. What does deputizing mean? I don't think our American listeners will know.
It means when you've got a regular job in a band or in a venue and you want a night off, so you have to get somebody else to take your place.
Got it.
Yeah, so my uncles used to give me these dep jobs and eventually, you know, I got my own jobs and... You know, it was all about just playing, really. So I got to 16, and I had gone to a traditional grammar school where if you were good at sport and you were good at music, it didn't really matter too much about the academic side, although, you know, it was very old school and very traditional. And I got a brilliant education, but I was also... My dad was a professional soccer player, and my mum from the jazz family. So I actually left school and was a professional soccer player for a year at Leeds United.
Oh, wow.
And I was still playing shows in the evening, and I eventually got kicked out of Leeds United because the manager didn't want me, you know, working every night. That wasn't the only reason I got kicked out. I was in all kinds of trouble and, you know, any loads of stories. But the fact was, you know, music was completely dominating my life. So I was very lucky. When I was 17, I got a record deal in my first band of my own and started making records. And the first record we made, which I also wrote, it got on the Radio 1 playlist. So in England, there's just really one radio station. And it got played all over the radio. And that was it, really. From that point on, I've been in the music industry. I spent 10 years as a musician after that, and it was just amazing. Wow. And, you know, like, just being born at the right time into the right families really was the reason why I managed to do all that.
Because I know we don't have too much time, and I want to cover both of your careers. So, Sarah, give us a little bit of background up to, like, if you can tell us, like, lead us up to how you and Kevin met and decided to create Dime.
Sure. So I started my career in the live music industry. I was on tours, as I mentioned, such as Barbara Streisand, Michael Jackson, Prince. But also on the Michael Jackson tour, I met a young band called The Influence, and I got on very well with their manager. So after I'd done the tour circuit, I started to work for her in management. I worked with her for 2 years, a year of which was in London, and the second year was actually in New York. And we managed The Influence, we managed a successful soul vocal group called Jeanne, and they were signed to Motown in America. We also managed Living Joy, who's just been on X Factor in the UK, which is bizarre, and she had a big club hit. So I had a great couple of years working in New York, but my visa ran out, so I knew I had to come back to the UK. So from there, I started again on tours, and it was actually on a Julio Iglesias tour that I met the chairman of Sony Music in the UK. And I don't know why, but he said to me, "I like your attitude. I've watched you for the last 3 nights, you work really hard, come and see me." So I went into his office a week later, and he said to me, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I don't know." I think I was 22, 23 at the time, and I said, "I really don't know what I want to do." I said, "But I know what I don't want to do." So we started to have a conversation, and he ended up saying, "Look, I don't know if I've got anything for you, but, you know, it's been really great to meet you." I said, "No problem, fine." And I went back to temping because I had my secretarial skills. And then 2 weeks later, the head of Sony Music International phoned me and said, "I've been recommended you by, you know, the UK chairman, Paul Berger, and will you come and see me?" So I went in to see him, and he said, "I like your attitude. Here's your job." And I was international promotions manager for Columbia Records, and started a week later. And I had a list of record companies around the world, and I had a stack of records on my desk, and I had my own office, and I had no idea what my job was or what I was meant to do. And it was only because his assistant was incredible, and there was a woman who worked up at Sony Music Europe who was also fantastic. So I kind of latched on to these two, and I learned how to do my job. I traveled a lot with my job. So my job was doing the promotion, working with record companies around the world on the promotion of UK acts in the rest of the world. So I traveled, you know, I was away most weeks, you know, at least 4 or 5 days a week. And then I'd come back, and weekends I'd go into Sony Music offices in London and prepare for the following week. And I was on a real entry salary, and I was working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I didn't complain. I loved it. It was the best job in the world. And I worked so hard, constantly jet lagged, but it was fantastic. And then after the first year, I got offered a promotion, and I think I more than doubled my salary, what they offered me. And then the following year, they offered me a directorship, and I was the youngest woman at Sony Music UK to ever be offered a directorship. But I turned it down, because at that point, 2 years previously, was when I met Kevin, who was managing a band who was signed to Sony Music UK. Kev, I don't know if you want to take the end of the story.
I want to hear from Kevin, though, a little bit about, Kevin, you put in your 10,000 hours before you were 20, it sounds like, as a musician.
Definitely.
And then, so you're a rock star, So how did, tell us a little bit about that, about the transition from going from a rock star into producing, managing, that type of thing.
Yeah, so I had, I started my recording career in Manchester at a studio called Strawberry Studios, which is owned by what was then the biggest band in England, who were called 10cc. Not only was I recording my own stuff, but I used to work with them, helping out in any way possible, including playing on other people's records. So I played bass on a Neil Sedaka record. I played on Paul McCartney's Brothers record. Loads of stuff. And actually, people started to cover my songs, which took me to London. So I left Manchester, went to London. The guy who was running the label that I was on, he actually left EMI and set up his own management company, so I went with him. And he managed four acts, one of which was me, another one was Alex Harvey, another one was a band called The Enid, who were like a progressive band. Anyway, Paul was a very kind of, he was almost like Malcolm McLaren, but a few years before. He was a brilliant guy, but he was crazy. And he suddenly started getting me loads of work in Europe as a producer, and I started having hits over there. So I was, you know, I was like in Belgium for 3 months, then I'd be in France for 3 months. It really gave me a grasp of the music industry outside of the UK. And I started to realize that much as I was loving being an artist and a session player as well, that on the producing side, I could make a lot more money. And so by the time I was in my mid-20s, I packed in touring and I became a full-time producer. And I had a couple of big records as a producer, but I kept handing my records over to managers who had no idea what they were doing. So eventually, I was producing a band, and their manager was so bad that I said to him, look, why don't you get rid of him and I'll help you? And so I did, and that band was a group called Little Angels. I signed them to Polydor, and we had 11 top 40 hits in a row, and then we had a number one album. And so I really started to get into the top end of the music industry at this point. And anyway, after Little Angels, I then went to New York for a year. So actually, Sarah and I were in New York at the same time, but didn't know each other. And I was working with Atlantic, and she was working with Sony. After the New York thing, I came back to England. I found this band, Cooler Shaker, who were on this tiny little label, but they were just an incredibly talented band. And they had a massive influence of the Beatles, which I've spent too much of my life studying and understanding. So We had an amazing bond, and so I was their manager, but I also produced them. And we got to the point in 1995 where we had virtually every record label in London wanting to sign us. And I chose Columbia mainly because I'd been in America before that, and I knew that Columbia Records was the number one label over there. And I was really keen to try and break America with this band. So I signed them to Columbia UK, and we instantly became huge. We sold 2 million of the debut album. But there was this girl called Sarah Clayman in the international department, and she was making everything happen in the international market. And so we built this really brilliant working relationship to the point that the guy who Sarah was talking about, the chairman, Paul Berger, I went to him in the end and I said, look, I need her working with me. And so we spent a year fighting over it, and I won.
Yay! Oh, that's so great. I love that. So now you guys are partners in crime, and so what happens? Sarah, you can take the lead on this. Tell us what was the next step for world domination.
So I worked the Cooler Shaker campaign for two and a half years with Kev, and then, you know, they had a break, and I was working other acts. But Columbia had gone through a few changes. We had a new MD, a new head of A&R, and I was working some very strange bands, and, you know, I just, my heart wasn't in it as much, I suppose. And, you know, I was, what was I at that time, 25, 26, and I just lost my desire to get out of bed, you know. I was just like dragging myself to the office every day. And I'd phone Kev because I had a working relationship with him, and I was just like, oh, this, I'm not feeling this, this is crazy. So he, whilst we were in the Cooler Shaker campaign, he said, just come and work with me, you know, come and be my sidekick at the management company. But I said to him, I'm so much more used to you in the label at the moment than I am with you. So when the campaign ended, you know, I became increasingly unhappy. Sony had offered me this directorship because they knew I was unhappy. And I said, yes. And then I thought about it and said, well, it doesn't matter what my job title is. I'm still unhappy. You know, I'm not in it for the money. I'm not in it for the job title. I want to do what I love doing. I want to work with bands that I love and I want to have new experiences. So Kev said, look, it's time to leave. And Kev at that time was head of A&R at V2 Records in the UK. And he needed someone to run his management company. So I left Sony and joined Kev in his management company. And we started to work together. Yeah, and we worked on 3 or 4 acts. We had a great time. Unfortunately, one of our artists, Kirsty McColl, had a record out at the time called Tropical Brainstorm, which was a huge success in England and did very well in Italy. She had a number one dance remix in Italy, which she was very proud of. And she went on holiday with her kids and unfortunately got killed in a scuba diving accident. And that changed our world. You know, we looked at each other and said, do we want to do this anymore? Do we want to sit in meetings with 40 people at a record company who are all arguing about insignificant things? You know, life is precious and you have to cherish every moment. And it was at that time we decided to go into music education and give back to the next generation of musicians.
Wow, that's really powerful. Kevin, take us from there. So now, you know, you want to give back, you want to create a music educational institution. How did you go about doing that?
So back in Little Angels days, before I met Sarah, one of the guys in the band, his dad was a music teacher and a headmaster, and one of the ways that I broke Little Angels was I took him into schools. We played in, it was astounding, no one had thought of it before, but we toured the UK and we played in schools at lunchtime and then played in rock clubs in the nighttime. And, you know, some of these schools had 1,000 kids in there. The connection with education came from that. So that was in 1989. And so I talked with Bruce, the guy in the band, and his dad a few times about, you know, I'd really like to do something at some point. Anyway, it was Bruce that first started an academy just for guitarists in Guildford in Surrey. And he asked me to be a consultant to it for a couple of years. So I did that. And I saw what he was doing. And there was a couple of other guys with him. And they were developing it into a music college. But they weren't doing it very well. And so I made some suggestions to him. But he hadn't got the right people there. So I got him to leave there. And me and Sarah and him set up our own music college. Because the thing is, no one was doing music education in modern music. It was all based around classical and jazz in education, and it still is. And so we wanted to do something that was significant, and also to do it in a way that we would prepare people for success. So we decided to do it in Brighton in England, which is only 60 miles from London, and it's a very cool place. It's like the San Francisco of England, but there'd been nothing going on there for quite a long time. We found a building down there, we took a lease on it, we fitted it out like a kind of like a studio, really, like a rehearsal studio, except it had teaching rooms in it. And then we found some really brilliantly talented music teachers who had had careers in the music industry, but had, you know, it come to an end. So we trained them up and we got going, and it just became such a rapid success. I mean, after 4 years, we had 1,000 students, and we had 3 buildings.
Oh, my God.
And then in the year 6... there was a band who was studying at our college. It was called BIM. And they became the Kooks. And we helped them get a record deal, me and Sarah. So they signed to Virgin Records. And they sold 2 million of their debut album. Soon after that, we had James Bay as a student. Then after that, we had Tom O'Dell. Then we had George Ezra. And by this point, we were in 4 cities, and so every one of those students sold more than 1 million of their debut album. But even though they are kind of the headlines of what we were doing, we were putting kids in jobs throughout the music industry. So we had 2,000 students after 10 years, and 70% of them were earning a full-time living out of music. And it's still going now. We actually came to America because the business got too big, and we were worried that percentage of kids getting jobs was going to reduce. And so we, because we'd both worked in America, we thought, well, we'll just go over there and do it, because you can keep going in America and never, ever saturate the market. And so here we are. You know, we've got two here now. We're in Detroit and in Denver. And we feel like we've only just started, to be honest. We've also got Dime Online in 22 countries. But we found something here that really works, because Sarah and I have got, Bruce dropped out of it, by the way, a few years ago, but Sarah and I have got such complementary skills. You know, me being a musician and her being a music industry person on the live side, that actually, you know, you put us together and there's pretty much, we've got it covered in pretty much the whole industry. And so we built the curriculum around that, and it connects with pretty much any kid who wants to get into the industry.
That's fantastic. I love that. Sarah, tell me a little bit just about, obviously, the music industry, and I'm not saying anything that you don't already know, but that the music industry has changed so much, especially in the past 5 years. How do you guys deal with that in terms of streaming, technology, content platforms? The sort of like the gatekeepers are no longer at the gate, the traditional gates, that kind of thing.
You know, in terms of our curriculum, we ensure that our instructors are professional musicians and music industry experts who are out there still working in the industry. So they've got their finger on the pulse, they know exactly what's going on, and we can update our curriculum, you know, on a semester by semester basis to make sure we really are kind of the cutting edge of the curriculum in the US and UK music industry, and we're getting it right, and we're teaching what is current in the music industry. In terms of us in the office, we are constantly learning. We spend a lot of time listening to our students, learning from our students. An example being that I walked around the building in Detroit specifically, and the students huddled in the corners, and they could be there for hours. I'm like, guys, what are you doing? And they're like, oh, we're just writing our midterm paper. And I'm like, but you're on your cell phones. They're like, yeah. And I'm like, well, you've got a computer suite there. Why don't you sit behind a computer? It will take you half the amount of time. They're like, no, we like doing it on our cell phones. Now, to me, being in my 40s, I'm like, are you guys crazy? But it is their culture, and we have to respect that culture, you know? So we spend a lot of time learning from students. They keep us on our toes in terms of, you know, social media and, you know, 1 minute you get your head around Facebook and then all the kids are onto Instagram, and then you get your head around Instagram, they're all onto Snapchat, and, you know, makes me feel very, very old. But, you know, I think it's really important because we are, you know, as educators, we're responsible for passing down our knowledge, but young people today have more knowledge than a lot of instructors out there. And if the instructors aren't keeping up to date with what the students are doing and what millennials and Gen X are doing, then we're not relevant, you know. And we've heard stories from, you know, some schools specifically in England where the students are challenging their instructors now and saying, well, that's not true, or what you've just taught me, I can Google that, you know. Why am I paying for higher ed, you know? What's the next thing? You know, the other big part of Dime's ethos is education should equal employability. Mm. And so we really spend a lot of time helping students understand how to write resumes, how to define their skills. You know, certainly with our performance and songwriting degrees, not every student who is studying guitar or vocals or songwriting is going to make it in the music industry. But we talk to the students a lot about, you know, it's not about playing guitar in your bedroom or being the next Kurt Cobain, it's everything in between. And we help students find their path in the music industry and say to them, look, if there are 19 singers in your class that are better than you, that's fine. You know, you might not be the next Alicia Cara or Lady Gaga, but think of all the other jobs you can do in the music industry. And so we open those jobs up to young students. And, you know, students come to any of our campuses or study online, and they don't know what a project manager is. They don't know what a radio plugger does. They don't know what marketing departments do. So through the curriculum and through our masterclass program, we open up the music industry to the students and help them with their skills, but also make contacts and connections and teach them how to network while they're on the program. So when they graduate from college, they're ready to get their job in the music industry. We spend a lot of time on that and a lot of focus on that.
Those are great points. Kevin, it's interesting that both of you did not go to music school, right? You didn't pursue that. You literally hit the ground running. It's very ironic in the fact that you've... Right. But, you know, that even that you both are, you know, running this institution, it's really interesting. And I wonder if you can speak to that, because I, for a number of my guests... Yeah. It's sort of a debate, you know, especially now, as you know, obviously there's a lot of music schools, there's now music business courses, et cetera, and there is sort of this debate, do you truly need to go to a music school to be successful? And I'm wondering if you can speak to that.
Yeah, the answer is yes, but only if it's a good one, and only if it's going to give you the skills in what you want to do. So our big thing is this. When we started, we went to talk to lots of universities, and all their music departments looked exactly alike. They all did classical and jazz. And when you found the odd university that did do, you know, pop music, as they would call it, the first thing they would do is build a recording studio. Well, that's a waste of time today, because the recording studio industry has been shrinking for 30 years. You know, when I was producing... In the 90s, I think there were 62, I think it was the number, 60-something anyway, top-level recording studios that major labels were working in. Today there's 5 in London. Mm-hmm. So why would you want to train people for an industry that's shrinking? And yeah. To the point that, if you bring that up to today, last year there's a kid called Steve Lacy who produced Kendrick Lamar. And he had a number one record, and the whole thing was on his iPhone. You know, so a bit like Sarah was saying about those kids doing their dissertations on their phones, then you can make records on your phones, mm-hmm. too. So the problem with the music industry and with the academic industry is they're constantly looking back. And our thing was, you know, there's no reason why an innovator in today's music, someone like Beyoncé, she's got just as much validity as Mozart, Lennon mm-hmm. and McCartney. You know, their songwriting, everybody's, because they're old now, everybody goes, oh, yeah, they're as good as Rodgers and Hammerstein or Beethoven. But actually, at the time, people used to ridicule them in the media. You know, the Beatles had 9 years of being told they would be over next year. So that dismissive kind of class system in music, it's really what we stand against. And so any music that comes here, kids studying at degree level, we only work with universities that really understand that today's musicians are going to be tomorrow's music industry executives. Yeah. And that's what we're interested in, is making sure that the industry remains strong and increases its visibility to young people who are not necessarily living in the key cities of LA, Nashville, New York, and London. So in our case, if there's a kid in rural Michigan who knows he's good enough and wants to get in the music industry, how the hell do you do that? How do you do it? Now we can come to Dime in Detroit. And really it stems, you know, like the model that really for me personally, you know, I come from rural Yorkshire. And I was the only kid in my town to ever get a major record deal. Well, there was plenty of other kids that could have done it, but they just didn't get a break and they didn't have the family thing that I had. So we're all about serving the underserved, and we're all about making music industry an available career for anybody, not just an elite few who happen to have a connection in the music industry.
Yeah. And also, you know, through our partnership with Metropolitan State University of Denver, who validate all our campuses in America, we have a national deal with them. They also, their motto is to serve the underserved. And traditionally, our students are likely to be the ones like myself, who are sitting in the back of the classroom, really creative kids, but not inspired by education. And so a lot of them haven't really done very well at high school. And so they can come in with slightly lower GPAs. We also have about 60% first-generation college students. And through MSU Denver, they can come in with a GPA as low as 1.4. And certainly in Michigan, no other college in the state can offer college education with a student with a GPA lower than 2.8. So that's a big difference. And when they come to Dime, they do well musically, but they also do well academically. Whereas during high school, they've probably been told that they're never going to go to college, they're never going to be college educated. Mm-hmm. And going back to your original question is, do musicians, songwriters, and people that want to work in the music industry, do they need to be college educated? The answer is yes, because there is so much competition out there that if you don't have a college education, you are not even going to get an interview for a job. You know, and what happens with specialist colleges like Dime, and what we are achieving already in the United States, is Dime is becoming a brand. So people in the music industry, when they look at the resumes and the CVs of these young people, and they can see they graduated from Dime, they know that they've had a really good education in music. And those young people being ready for employment, trained for employment and trained by Dime and Dime instructors with Dime ethos, is going to get them to the head of the pack of getting those great jobs. An example of that is a year and a half ago, our first graduating class in Detroit, young female black student, graduated from Dime. She was our valedictorian, and the next day she flew to New York to work in the urban promo department of Republic Records, which is one of America's biggest record labels. And she got that job the day after graduation, and we're super proud of her. So we can see it works.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. Just a couple quick last questions. First, is Dime going to expand to any other cities? And secondly, is Dime open to students of all ages, or is it just specifically, you know, like 18 to 25 or something like that?
Okay, so it is going to go to more cities. Like, watch this space, because we're talking right now about doing something on the west coast of America. So that's that. And then from there, yeah, I mean, you know, we're not planning to stop. We're going to be doing this forever, really. So, like, we're not, and it's not just America, you know. We're in the international music business. One of the great things about since the industry went digital in 2000 with Napster is, you know, you can put a record out in Denver and in Beijing at the same minute today. And so, you know, we view the music industry globally. And that's where Dime is going. You know, we've got so many things going on right now, and it's all so exciting, and so it's all going to come to fruition over the next few years. The second part of the question, absolutely anybody can come here. We have no prejudice in any way about anything. And because we are putting people in every aspect of the music industry, you know, people in their 40s and 50s get jobs too. You know, someone's got to do the jazz catalogue at Capitol Records. He happens to be a friend of ours. But, you know, he's in his 60s. Well, you don't really find people every day for those kind of jobs. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we would hate to think that people feel intimidated just because this is a young environment. But the reason why it's a young environment is that music industry is also the fashion industry. And so young people are the ones that are changing it. You know, you asked Sarah a question a minute ago about, you know, how do you keep up with the music industry? Well, the people who are making those innovative ideas are the public. It's not the industry. And so the environment here at Dime, I'm sitting in Dime Denver right now, it doesn't really matter whether you're a student or you're an instructor, because we're all working together for the same thing. And so there's a place for everybody, but yes, it's a young environment. So if you are a bit older, as long as you're able to get on with younger kids, you'll have a great time here.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I'm thinking maybe I need to take
Yes, come on.
Come on, we'll find something for you.
And just to round that off, we also do short courses and part-time 6-week programs as well online at Dime Denver and at Dime Detroit. So there's lots of options for many of your listeners.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Sarah and Kevin. This has just been such a wonderful interview, and I think you really inspired a lot of people.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Again, special thanks to both Kevin and Sarah for a phenomenal interview. Loved hearing about their incredible music career trajectories. Just so fascinating and very, very inspiring. And obviously also about Dime. all about Dime. You can find out more at dime-detroit.com or dime-denver.com. I urge you to go check them out. Obviously, they also offer the online courses and workshops, and they are expanding, so be sure to follow them on social media to stay up to date as to what is going on with them, because it just sounds super exciting, and they really truly are on the cutting edge of the modern music industry. So my loves, thus ends another week of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, L. Ariel. I can't believe it's already November. I hope everyone had a wonderful Halloween. I have a show coming up on November 13th at Bar Lubbitsch in West Hollywood. If you are in town and feel like coming out, I would love, love, love to see you. Again, that's Bar Lubbitsch. You can get more information on my website, lariel-music.com. That's lariel-music.com. Follow us on social media at Music Jobs Podcast, or you can follow me at L-A-R-I-E-L Music. And I hope that everyone has a wonderful, productive, amazing, inspiring week. Keep on chugging, everybody. Let's go. We are going to keep on hustling, pursue that dream, and we are not going to give up.